Now, pastor and author Charles Swindoll wrote the following words, quote, God is forever on a quest. His pursuit is a subject woven through the fabric of the New Testament. The pattern he follows is set forth in Romans 8:29, where he promises to conform us to his son's image. Another promise is stated in Philippians 1:6, where we're told he began his work and he isn't about to stop. Elsewhere, he even calls us his workmanship. He is hammering, filing, chiseling, and shaping us. Peter's second letter goes so far as to list some of the things included in this quest: diligence, faith, moral excellence, knowledge, self-control, perseverance, godliness, kindness, and love. In a word, character. Character in his children. That's God's relentless quest. That's well said. Now, character can be defined as the inherent complex of attributes that determines a person's moral and ethical actions and reactions. In other words, your character determines your behavior. Your words, your thoughts, your actions, your reactions, they reveal your true character. I often see someone, you know, make a mistake at sports, or they lose their mind in the press conference. They say, well, that's not really who I am. I was just caught up in the moment. No, that's really who you are. It was revealed. It's been said that people are like tubes of toothpaste. You squeeze them to see what's inside. And what happens to us is our character is revealed through our life, who we are when no one's looking. And that character is very, very important to God. So as Charles Swindoll pointed out, God is intimately concerned with your character and with my character, because God wants to conform our character to the character of Christ. And one of the ways that the Lord God does this is by recording examples in the Bible of people's character, both good character and bad character. As we see the outworking of character in the lives of biblical figures, then we can choose either to emulate their good example or hopefully to avoid their negative course of action. As we continue our verse-by-verse study of the book of Genesis this morning, we're going to see a few things to imitate and many things to avoid as we examine the character of the individuals of Genesis 33 and 34 in a message I've entitled, Character Matters. I've divided these two chapters into four different sections. We'll see, first of all, Esau's humility, then Jacob's deception, Shechem's impatience, and finally, double duplicity. So let's move into our first section, and that's Esau's humility. We'll find this in the first 11 verses of Genesis chapter 33. Verse 1, Moses writes, Now Jacob lifted his eyes and looked, and there Esau was coming. With him were 400 men. It's been a couple of weeks since we've been in the book of Genesis, and just to remind you of what's going on here, is that Jacob was on his way back to the promised land. He'd left Laban, and he was there with his wives and his children and his flocks. And he was really worried because he'd heard that Esau was coming to meet him with 400 men. And last, the way they'd left things had not gone well between Jacob and Esau. And so this moment of truth arrives here in verse 1. Esau and his 400 men come face to face with Jacob and his caravan. Notice, so he divided the children among Leah, Rachel, and the two maidservants. So Jacob, ever the planner, some might say ever the schemer, he separates his children up among the four mothers. Verse 2, and he put the maidservants and their children in front. Unfortunately, it was clear to all that Jacob was playing favorites with the mothers and their children. The maidservants Bilhah and Zilpah and their kids, Dan, Naphtali, Gad, and Asher, are the first in line. But this is not like being first in line to get ice cream. If you're first in line to get ice cream, awesome. This is exactly where I want to be. This is more like being first in line at the Battle of Gettysburg. Hey, we want you to kind of be cannon fodder. When the shooting starts, why don't you get out in the front and absorb it for us? That's what's going on here. Jacob was basically putting his least favorite children and his least favorite wives first so that the more favored children and the more favored wives could get away if there was an attack. It's not good. And this shows us the danger of favoritism. Because as we see the rest of the life of Jacob, we see this favoritism coming out again and again, and it especially comes to a head with Joseph. And we'll spend quite a bit of time looking at the life of Joseph, but Joseph is, since he is favored by Jacob, he is hated by the other brothers. Now, continuing on in verse 2, we read, Leah and her children behind. Okay, so the two maidservants, and then now Leah and her children, Leah with Reuben, Simeon, Levi, Judah, Issachar, and Zebulun, as well as Dinah, and then Rachel and Joseph last. So as far as Jacob was concerned, this was a true save the best for last situation. His favorite wife and his favorite child. Rachel and Joseph were benefited with the best chance to escape if an attack took place. Now, even though Jacob does err in showing favoritism, what he does next is honorable. Notice in verse 3, then he crossed over before them. So Jacob has his moments of doing the right thing, and he does that here. Even though he lines them up in such a way as to clearly show who are his favorites, he still chooses to go out front. He chooses to cross over before all his family members. He was taking the lead. He was now willing to be the first one to make contact with Esau, and so that's a good thing. As Jacob approached Esau, he bowed himself to the ground 7 times until he came near to his brother. And so this is what we might call a very servile action. He's showing complete submission to Esau. We see throughout the scriptures, and it's not only in the scriptures, but in all of the ancient world, this number 7 is a number of completion. So to bow to the ground 7 times, Jacob is showing complete submission to Esau. He's doing this thing. Now, as we think about this situation, it's important to remember that it was Jacob who had put himself into this difficult spot. You and I have probably been in that same situation where we've said something or done something to offend someone. It's our fault. And so what do? We kind of avoid them. If it's a fellow coworker, we see them in the hall and we duck into the closet, let them pass by, and then we come back out once they're gone. And that sort of thing. Well, maybe that's only me who does that kind of stuff. No. It was Jacob's fault, though. Jacob had deceived Isaac by pretending to be Esau and caused all this trouble. So Jacob has a guilty conscience when he sees Esau again. He's worried about how this is going to turn out. And there's a reminder for us here that we cause ourselves grief when we try to help God out instead of obediently serving and trusting him. You see, God had already promised that Jacob was going to receive the blessing, that Esau was going to serve Jacob. But Jacob had taken matters into his own hands. He was trying to help God out, and it turned out poorly. Same thing when Abraham and Sarah took matters into their own hands and had the quote-unquote promised son through Hagar. It worked out poorly. You know, the Lord's been moving in my life and to get back to making prayer a higher priority in my own life. You know, I've been reading about prayer and thinking about prayer and praying more. And I was driving to school the other day praying, and I was realizing that how, when I don't pray, I just try to get things done without consulting the Lord, and how much pressure and stress that puts on me. But as I was driving, it was kind of like the Lord was just like, hey, why don't you talk to me about it? Why don't you offer these things to me? Why don't you give them over to me instead of just trying to figure out everything on your own? I have so much of Jacob in me, and maybe you have a lot of Jacob in you. Just trying to take matters into your own hands, and then you find it turning out poorly. Now, as we move into verse 4, we see something quite unexpected. But Esau ran to meet him and embraced him and fell on his neck and kissed him, and they wept. That's unexpected. This is not what we were thinking was going to happen. This is an amazing scene. And maybe you're in a position where you've read the book of Genesis many times and you've kind of lost it. And like, Steve already knew what was going to happen. I knew Jacob and Esau were going to get along, and that's cool. But look at it for the first time again. I mean, think about this. The last time we saw Esau, Esau would go to bed at night thinking, one day I'm going to kill Jacob. And he would smile. That he consoled himself with that idea. But now something has changed in Esau. Now Esau runs to Jacob, he gives him a bear hug, he kisses him on the cheek, and they both break down crying. It's an awesome scene. And what's so crazy as we move through chapter 33 and chapter 34 today, the character who we should most emulate is Esau. It's a crazy turn of events. Esau is this guy who, in this situation, looks not unsimilar to not dissimilar to the Apostle Paul. A guy who was a murderer and chasing down the church, and all of a sudden Paul's this guy who's laying down his life for fellow believers. That's what we see in Esau here. And this is one of the most beautiful reconciliation scenes in the entire Bible. In fact, as I was reading through this, it reminded me so much of the father's response in the parable of the prodigal son. Remember the parable of the prodigal son? The son has done wrong, and before the son can repent and say all these things to the father runs out to him and greets him, embraces him, and brings him back into his household. And that's really what we see here from Esau. Esau displays this wonderful character. And it's interesting to note that Esau's character here is that he sees no need to dredge up the past and make Jacob answer for all his wrongs. And it's his power to do so. He said, I've got 400 men, Jake. Hey, let's talk about this for a minute. Why don't you just get down on your knees and apologize for how you ripped me off? And we don't see any of that. He doesn't wait to see if Jacob's a changed man or anything. It's out of Esau's character that he embraces Jacob and wants to restore fellowship with him. I think that's awesome. It's a beautiful. Esau simply forgave Jacob and offered immediate reconciliation. Amazing. Now, we don't know what caused Esau's change of heart. We don't know what led to this humble attitude. But we do know that in this circumstance, the Lord was making good on his promise to protect Jacob and to bring him back into the promised land. Really, God has said that. I'm going to bring you back. I'm going to take care of you. Don't worry about it. But Jacob was worried about it, and the Lord made the way. Now, this is an important point, though. You see, Jacob was assuming the worst. And he assumed that everything was working against him, when in reality, the Lord was working things in Jacob's favor. I can do this, and there are, you know, students and different individuals that I've ministered to over time, and they assume in every situation that, like, I'm out to get them. And I'm not out to get them. And I want the best for them. I want to help them and help them to grow. But there's the boogeyman waiting around the corner. And that's just not true. And Jacob is going to kind of go through this over and over again. He assumes that all things are against him. And the question for us is we look at our own character, is our character such that we assume the worst about situations? Are we quick to behave as if God has left us to fend for ourselves? And if that's you today, I'm not here to pick on you, but I'm trying to give you some perspective because that's me. I constantly assume the worst. But if we do, if we assume the worst, if you assume the worst, if I assume the worst, then we're not seeing situations clearly. And what we need to do is go to the Lord in prayer and get back into the Word of God. We need to pray and study God's Word and see if that's really what God says. We need to really see if God is working all things together for the horrible despair of the believer. We need to see if that's anywhere in the Scriptures. You see, if you assume the worst, remember that God has promised to work all things for the good of the believer. Romans 8:28 says, "And we know that all things work together for good to those who love God, to those who are the called according to his purpose." That's what God's word says. If you assume the worst, remember that whatever we may suffer as believers, it will soon be past. Paul says in 2 Corinthians 4, verses 16 through 18, "Therefore we do not lose heart, even though our outward man is perishing, yet the inward man is being renewed day by day. For our light affliction, which is but for a moment, is working for us a far more exceeding and eternal weight of glory, while we do not look at the things which are seen, but the things which are not seen. For the things which are seen are temporary, but the things which are not seen are eternal." If you assume the worst, remember that God has promised to always be with the believer. Hebrews 13, verses 5 and 6 says, "Let your conduct be without covetousness. Be content with such things as you have. For he himself has said, I will never leave you nor forsake you. So we may boldly say, the Lord is my helper. I will not fear. What can man do to me?" He can kill me, and then he sends me to the Lord. That's what he can do to me. And so we can trust that the Lord has our best interests in mind. And these are just a few of the many scriptural promises to remind ourselves when we find ourselves despairing of our situation. If you find yourself in a place today and your situation is dire, and there are dire and difficult situations in a fallen world, then I would encourage you, get back into the Word and get back into prayer and find that comfort from Him. Now, as we move on in Genesis 33 to verse 5, Esau speaks to Jacob. He says, "And he lifted his eyes and saw the women and the children and said, who are these with you? So he said, the children whom God has graciously given your servant." It's good. This is good verbiage that Jacob is using. Jacob seems to be acknowledging that God had given these children to him. So it's a little bit of a witness there as he's sharing the truth of the one true God with Esau. Verse 6, then the maidservants came near, they and their children, and bowed down. And Leah also came near with her children, and they bowed down. And afterward, Joseph and Rachel came near, and they bowed down. So we have this procession here, and all the children and their mothers bow in submission to Esau. Verse 8, then Esau said, what do you mean by all this company which I met? So Esau is asking about the 550 plus animals that had been sent to him by Jacob. Remember, that was Jacob was trying to appease Esau. He says, well, by the time he gets to me, he's going to be so overwhelmed with these gifts, maybe he won't kill me. Continuing on in verse 8. And he said, in other words, Jacob said, these are to find favor in the sight of my Lord. But Esau said, I have enough, my brother. Keep what you have for yourself. Now, I missed something very important in my first run through here in verse 9. Notice that Esau calls him my brother. I love that. I love the fact that Esau refers to Jacob as my brother. He doesn't say, hey, scumbag. Could have. Hey, liar face. You know, he doesn't say any of these things. Hey, servant, you know, guy about to get pummeled. He doesn't do any of these things. He calls him my brother. It's beautiful. And this character displayed by Esau is something that we should emulate because it blends beautifully with what Peter commanded in 1 Peter chapter 3, verses 8 and 9. Peter wrote this, finally, all of you be of one mind, having compassion for one another, love as brothers, be tenderhearted, be courteous, not returning evil for evil or reviling for reviling, but on the contrary, blessing, knowing that you were called to this, that you may inherit a blessing. I love that. He says, Peter says, let's love each other like brothers. And Esau was manifesting that character. Now, continuing on in Genesis 33 to verse 10, and Jacob said, no, please. If I have now found favor in your sight, then receive my present from my hand, inasmuch as I have seen your face as though I had seen the face of God, and you were pleased with me. Now, when he says, I've seen your face as though I've seen the face of God, it could be that Jacob is just like totally buttering up Esau. Could be. Man, when I saw you, it was like seeing God. It was so awesome. Or Jacob could be saying, I've seen God work in this situation. It's like I can see God moving in this situation because of how you're treating me. That's kind of what I would lean to. Jacob seems to be acknowledging the fact that it was God who brought about this change in Esau. And you and I probably witnessed this. We saw someone who we thought would never get saved, and then they get saved, and we're like, it's like seeing God. We're seeing this miracle of how different you are. Probably we don't say it to their face. But that's how we feel. Verse 11. Jacob says, please take my blessing that is brought to you, because God has dealt graciously with me, and because I have enough. So he urged him, and he took it. So Jacob really convinces Esau to take the animals, and after initially refusing, Esau humbly accepts the gift. And it's likely that Esau accepts this gift because he sensed that Jacob was trying to make restitution. And that's why Esau accepted the animals. I mean, like for you as a parent, you know, your child does something wrong and they kind of make you this handmade card apologizing for what they've done. If they haven't done that, you need to train your kids to do such things. But they bring you this card and you're like, well, this is not the best craftsmanship. But I realize what they're trying to do. They're trying to get, and I'm gonna receive that. So for you as a parent, if you said, you know, I'm not going to take your card, you just keep that. You break the spirit of that child. They're trying to make reconciliation with you. I love what David Guzik says, quote, in that culture, you never accepted a gift from an enemy, only from a friend. To accept the gift was to accept the friendship. So Esau's character was such that it was by in accepting these animals, he's saying to Jacob, we're good. You know, you and I are okay. So whatever the specifics of this exchange were, there is something to be said for being a humble receiver. You know, especially here in America, it's, you know, especially among a certain portion of individuals in America, there's this culture of, hey, I need to do it myself. You know, nobody needs to help me. Nobody needs to give me a hand. You know, I'm a self-made man. I'm a self-made woman. And there's what can happen is we can refuse to accept the gifts of others, the help of others. We can refuse to ask for prayer from others because we just want to do it ourselves. But you know what? All that is it's just pride. It's pride, an unwillingness to accept the gift of others or the help of others or the prayer of others, the shoulder to cry on of others is pride. And so I love that Esau doesn't go and say, well, you know what, I'm just too big and I'm too important. I don't need your gifts. He accepts them in humility, and I think we would do well to accept gifts in humility as well. With that said, let's move now from Esau's humility to our second section, and that's Jacob's deception. We'll find this in verses 12 through 20 of chapter 33. Verse 12, then Esau said, hey, let us take our journey. Let us go, and I will go before you. Esau is like, hey, man, let's go. Let's hang out. Let's go together, and we'll travel together, and it's going to be awesome. And what's so interesting is with these words, it becomes clear why Esau brought 400 men with him. Jacob assumed that those 400 men were to attack him, but in fact, these 400 men were to protect him. Esau brought these men because he wanted to give Jacob an escort. He was seeking to protect Jacob and his company from any hostile forces. And again, this paints a beautiful picture. And it shows how the perspective of Jacob was so skewed. He was assuming the worst, but in reality, Esau wanted the best for him. Now, as we move into Jacob's response, it is worth noting that as fallen human beings, we have a tendency to fall back into our old way of doing things when we're stressed. We just kind of go back to that. For me as a kid, I was just a liar, and I would lie on top of lie because I just wanted to avoid getting in trouble. And still, I felt that pressure even as an adult. Get caught in a situation, and like, am I going to go back to lying? It's just in our nature. But the fact of the matter is, we don't have to do that. Just because we have these old tendencies or old structures or old frameworks or whatever you want to call it, this fallen nature that remains in ourselves, we don't have to submit to that. We don't have to go back to that. We can choose to do something differently. In fact, Paul says in Galatians 5:16, he says, I say then, walk in the Spirit and you shall not fulfill the lust of the flesh. The lust of the flesh, our desires, are to do those old things, to live according to that sin nature. But if we walk in the Spirit, if we submit to the Spirit, we can actually live differently. We can do something differently. Unfortunately, Jacob's primary sinful tendency was deceit, and he gives into it here. Notice in verses 13 and 14. But Jacob said to him, my Lord knows that the children are weak, and the flocks and herds which are nursing are with me. And if the men should drive them hard one day, all the flock will die. Please let my Lord go on ahead before his servant. I will lead on slowly at a pace with the livestock that go before me and the children and are able to endure, and I will come to my Lord in Seir. Now, this was a deceptive excuse. He's basically saying, man, I've got young kids and I've got, you know, these animals and I really don't want to press them too hard. And so here's the deal. Why don't you go on ahead and I'll catch up with you? Your friends ever done that to you before? You go ahead and I'll meet you there. And they never show. That's what's going on here. You guys have had it happen. Maybe you're the one that does that to your friends. See, Jacob had no intention of going to Seir. This was an area south of the Dead Sea where Esau made his home. And the fact of the matter is, if Jacob didn't want to go there, he could have had a conversation with Esau. And he could have said, you know, that's not where the Lord's calling me. I appreciate it. I love you for it. But you know what? I really need to go where the Lord's taking me. But he doesn't do that. He says he's going to go there, but he has no intention of going there. Verse 15, and Esau said, now let me leave with you some of these people who are with me. He said, let me leave you a guard. You know, let me leave some guys to protect you and to escort you there. Esau wants to leave some men with Jacob to protect him, his people, and his possessions. But Jacob's having none of it. But he said, what need is there? Let me find favor in the sight of my Lord. So Esau returned that day on his way to Seir. And Jacob journeyed to Succoth, built himself a house, and made booths for his livestock. Therefore, the name of the place is called Succoth, which means booths. Now, this may seem pretty innocuous to us if we don't kind of have a map in front of us. But instead of heading south like Esau went, like he said he would, he actually kind of, I guess, waited until Esau got out of sight and went the other direction. Jacob actually headed in the opposite direction. He went north to Succoth. This area was east of the Jordan River and north of the Jabbok River. And before we move into verse 18, I have to mention the fact that Jacob's poor character caused him to be a terrible witness to Esau. It's tragic. Jacob had this opportunity of reconciliation with his brother, and think about all he could have done. He could have said to him, you know what, bud, I need to go back to this other place because that's really where God's calling me. But before I go, let's catch up. Let me tell you about what God's been doing in my life. Let me tell you about how when I left you after I deceived you, how I was there at this place and I went to sleep and I saw a ladder to heaven. And I saw angels coming up and down, and God spoke to me there and promised to bring me back, and here I am. And then Laban, our uncle, you remember Laban, he treated me badly. But you know what? God spoke to me, and God prospered me and protected me. And then right before I got to see you, I wrestled with God an entire night. He could have said all these things. He could have shared this truth with Esau, yet he ruined that opportunity by choosing to be deceptive once again. And if he caught up with Esau again, would Esau believe him? Esau would no longer believe that witness because he couldn't even trust Jacob to be truthful about where he was going. Jacob seemed like the same old deceiver. And there's an exhortation for all of us that we need to cultivate honest character in all areas of our lives if we want to be effective witnesses. Why should people believe you and I regarding spiritual things if we don't tell the truth regarding earthly things? Why should they believe what we have to say about an invisible God if they can't believe what we have to say about things that happen here on a daily basis? It's important for us. That honesty is so vital. Verse 18. Then Jacob came safely to the city of Shechem, which is in the land of Canaan. And then when he came from Paddan Aram, and he pitched his tent before the city. So Shechem was directly west of the Jabbok River, and it was about 20 miles from the Jordan in the land of Canaan. And this is the place where Abram had first encamped when he arrived in Canaan. Genesis 12, verses 5 and 6 read, Then Abraham took Sarai his wife, and Lot his brother's son, and all their possessions which they had gathered, and the people whom they had acquired in Haran, and they departed to the land of Canaan. And they came to the land of Canaan. Abraham passed through the land to the place of Shechem, as far as the terebinth tree of Morah, and the Canaanites were then in the land. So moving on now in Genesis 33 to verse 19, we read, And he bought the parcel of land where he had pitched his tent from the children of Hamor, Shechem's father, for 100 pieces of money. Okay. So Jacob comes to this land, and then he's a wealthy man, and so he buys a piece of land from the children of Hamor, Shechem's father. And so there's these people that are the overseers of the land. I guess they own the land, and so he buys it from them. Now, it's interesting to note that this piece of land that Jacob bought is the same place where the bones of his favorite son, Joseph, would be buried over 500 years later. Read about this in Joshua 24, verse 32. It says, The bones of Joseph, which the children of Israel had brought up out of Egypt, they buried at Shechem, in the plot of ground which Jacob had bought from the sons of Hamor, the father of Shechem, for 100 pieces of silver, which had become an inheritance of the children of Joseph. So interesting kind of how the symmetry is. But with that said, I would argue that Jacob never should have gone to Shechem in the first place. You see, in Genesis 31, verse 13, we read these words, as the Lord had spoke to Jacob before he left Laban's house, said this, I am the God of Bethel. The God of Bethel, not the God of Shechem. I am the God of Bethel, where you anointed the pillar and where you made a vow to me. Now arise, get out of this land and return to the land of your family. I believe that God is instructing Jacob to go back to Bethel. And in fact, we're going to read the following words in Genesis 35, verse 1. And then God said to Jacob, Arise, go up to Bethel and dwell there, and make an altar there to God, who appeared to you when you fled from the face of Esau, your brother. You see, I believe God was directing Jacob to go back to where he had met with him before, to go back to that place. And I think it's really important for us. For us, when we kind of wander through the world, we need to go back to where we've met with God. We need to go back to our first love. We need to go back to Bethel, the house of God. Because there are great dangers when you settle in a place where you're not supposed to be. I'm sure my students at school, get sick of hearing me ask about this, but the seniors are contemplating where they're going to go to college, and I ask them, hey, where are you going to go to church there? Oh, well, you know, I haven't really thought about that yet. That kind of attitude. And so I challenge them on that because it's important. Because when you go to college, it's a lot like moving to Sodom. There's all kinds of wickedness around bombarding you. And it's important to have a fellowship of believers that can hold you accountable so you can stay anchored in the midst of this messed up world. And so this is where Jacob is. Jacob's not in the place where he needs to be. And it reminds me a lot of Lot, of when Lot moved to Sodom and how it affected his family. And we're going to see something similar as we move through the next chapter. Now, continuing on in Genesis 33 to verse 20, it says, then he erected an altar there and called it El Elohe Israel. So Jacob built an altar and named it El Elohe Israel, which means El is the God of Israel. So in doing so, Jacob is likely acknowledging the fact that the Lord had led him back all the way back into the promised land. And it's a good reminder that even though I believe Jacob's in the wrong place, he's at least acknowledging that it's God who's protected him, God who's provided for him. It's a reminder to us to give credit where credit is due. You can't thank the Lord enough for all that he's done for you. You can't. If you continually in prayer just offer thanksgiving to the Lord, that's not a bad thing. He needs to be thanked because he's worthy of it. I love the way it's put in Psalm 107, verse 15. Oh, that men would give thanks to the Lord for his goodness and for his wonderful works to the children of men. As we just offer this thanksgiving to God, as we give credit where credit's due, God will change our character. We will become more and more thankful. People will have better and better perspective because we'll rightly acknowledge God for who he is and for what he's done. All right, let's move now from Jacob's deception to our third section, and that's Shechem's impatience. Find this in chapter 34, verses 1 through 5. I want to read for you 1 Corinthians 13:4 from the NIV, and it puts it this way. Love is patient, love is kind. Love is patient, love is kind. Unfortunately, Shechem, the son of Hamor, like most people in human history, did not agree. You see, Shechem confused lust with love. He saw what he wanted, and he took it without patiently waiting for the proper time. And as a result, many individuals would suffer because of his impatience. And this is a reminder when it comes to matters of character, is that no one sins unto themselves. Our sin always affects others, and we have no idea just how damaging and far-reaching those effects will be. We have to be careful about that. And there's often, you know, things in our society that people say, well, it's a victimless crime. Not so. Because any sin affects God. Any sin affects God, but any sin not only affects God, but it affects you. And then it changes you and it affects everyone you come into contact with. So sin affects many, many individuals. No one sins unto themselves. Moving on in verse 1 of Genesis 34, it says, now Dinah, the daughter of Leah, whom she had born to Jacob, went out to see the daughters of the land. As a father of teenage daughters, I just think, what are you doing, Jacob? This is a foolish move. Hey, Dad, I'm going to go into town and hang out with the local pagan girls. see how that turns out for me. It's just ludicrous that Jacob would allow his daughter to just go and hang out with the unbelievers of the land. Paul says in 1 Corinthians 15:33, do not be deceived. Evil company corrupts good habits. No one but Jesus is immune from this. Jesus was the only person in human history that could hang around all kinds of ungodly people and not be affected. Anyone else, if we spend all of our time hanging out around ungodly people, we are going to be corrupted. It's just going to happen. And just as the daughters of Lot were corrupted by the people of Sodom, so Dinah will be corrupted by Shechem. Verse 2, and when Shechem, the son of Hamor, the Hivite, prince of the country, saw her, he took her and lay with her and violated her. So most commentators believe that Shechem sexually assaulted Dinah here, that he raped her. Commentators note, quote, unattached young women were considered fair game in cities of the time, in which promiscuity was not only common, but in fact a part of the very religious system itself. This occurrence serves to illustrate the low standard of morals prevalent among the Canaanites. Any unattended female could be raped, and the transactions that ensue, neither father nor son feel the need of apologizing for or excusing what had been committed. It's a horrible picture, and it's terrible, but we see the character of Jacob leading to this. We see Jacob refusing, not going to the place where God called him to. We see Jacob lying to Esau. We see Jacob allowing his daughter to go in and hang around with these ungodly people. It's a mess. And though we don't know exactly what took place between Shechem and Dinah, we do know that Shechem was a sinful aggressor and that Dinah never should have been in that town in the first place. Verse 3, his soul was strongly attracted to Dinah, the daughter of Jacob, and he loved the young woman and spoke kindly to the young woman. So Shechem spoke to his father Hamor, saying, "Get me this young woman as a wife." Now, regarding this so-called love of Shechem, David Guzik writes, quote, "It was a selfish love that Shechem had for Dinah, not a spiritual or godly love. He loved her for what she could be and give to him, not for what he could be and give to her. His heart is shown in the words, 'Get me this young woman as a wife.' It was a selfish, get me kind of love. It is possible for a man to be attracted to a woman and to show kindness to her for reasons having nothing or little to do with love. In their desire to connect romantically with a man, women often forget this." Now, again, all this could have been avoided if Jacob had forbidden Dinah from hanging out in an ungodly town. Or better yet, if Jacob had just gone to Bethel in the first place. And so I would encourage both parents and children to heed the warning of this chapter, to realize that no matter how strong believers think that they are, if they hang around in ungodly places, ungodly things happen. It's just that's the nature of the unbeliever. Verse 5. Now Jacob heard that he had defiled Dinah his daughter. Now his sons were with his livestock in the field. So Jacob held his peace until they came. There seems to be a shocking lack of righteous anger on the part of Jacob. That you hear that this thing has happened, and it's not just come out and said it, but if you read between the lines, they didn't even return Dinah. So Dinah is still at Shechem's house. So he's done this thing to her, and then he hasn't even let her go. He's kind of like kidnapped her, in a sense. And so with all this happening, Jacob is just kind of stoic about the whole thing. But this lack of righteous anger really is not surprising when you consider how Jacob has done things throughout. He often prefers scheming and plotting to open confrontation. And tragically, Jacob's failure to properly respond to the violence against his daughter would lead to terrible bloodshed. One commentator says, quote, "Jacob shows a distinct lack of outrage here. He seemed to take the defilement of his only daughter easily. His refusal to do what is right in regard to his family will encourage two of his sons to do something ungodly in response. When God-appointed heads do not take appropriate leadership, it creates a void which is often filled sinfully." If you're familiar with the Old Testament, then you know something very similar to this took place among David's children. David's son Amnon raped his half-sister Tamar, and shockingly, David failed to do anything about it. And so Absalom, who was a full brother of Tamar, he had Amnon murdered. And it was only a matter of time until Absalom was in full-scale rebellion against David. And so we have Jacob and David, both with daughters who were raped and both doing nothing about it. And then the sons saying, "Well, I'll do something about it if you won't." And there's a valuable lesson for us here that as parents, we must be diligent to deal with the issues in our household or our kids may take matters into their own hands. It's important for spiritual leaders to deal with things, for parents to deal with things so that their kids won't feel that compulsion to take care of it for them. We move now from Shechem's impatience to our final section, and that's double duplicity here in verses 6 through 31. Verse 6 and 7. Then Hamor, the father of Shechem, went out to Jacob to speak with him. And the sons of Jacob came in from the fields when they heard it, and the men were grieved and very angry, because he had done a disgraceful thing in Israel by lying with Jacob's daughter, a thing which ought not to be done. This is a powder keg about to explode. We have Hamor on one side trying to get Dinah as a wife for his son Shechem. On the other side, we have the furious sons of Jacob who are rightly outraged by what has been done to their sister. This is a bad situation. And Jacob is strangely silent through this whole chapter. Now, something's got to give. Verse 8. But Hamor spoke with him, saying, "The soul of my son Shechem longs for your daughter. Please give her to him as a wife and make marriages with us. Give us your daughters to us and take our daughters to yourselves. So you shall dwell with us and the land shall be before you. Dwell and trade in it and acquire possessions for yourselves in it." This is a dangerous proposition that Hamor brings to Jacob. Hamor wants to welcome Jacob into the family. Hamor is proposing intermarriage with the pagans. Paul famously warned against this sort of thing. 2 Corinthians chapter 6, verses 14 and 15. It says, "Do not be unequally yoked together with unbelievers. For what fellowship has righteousness with lawlessness? Or what communion has light with darkness? And what accord has Christ with Belial? Or what part has a believer with an unbeliever?" It's a very dangerous situation to get in. So it's important that believers avoid these romantic entanglements with unbelievers because they don't share the same values. You know, Aristotle, we study him at school, and he talks about the three types of friendships. There's the pleasure friendship, where you just, you know, you hang out with somebody because they make you feel good. There's a utility friendship, which you're just with someone because of what they can give to you, because maybe they have some money or they have position, and so you hang around with them because of those fringe benefits. And then there's the virtuous friendship, that you share the same values, you the same character, so you can actually have a true relationship. It's impossible to have a true relationship, a virtuous relationship between a believer and an unbeliever, because you don't share the same values. The believer, if you say Christ is number one, and the unbeliever, by definition, Christ is not number one, those are not the same values. So to try to say, well, we can work around that, is a foolish proposition. Verse 11, "Then Shechem said to her father and her brothers, 'Let me find favor in your eyes, and whatever you say to me, I will give. Ask me ever so much dowry and gift, and I will give according to what you say to me, but give me the young woman as a wife.'" This was beyond insulting. Basically just, hey, she's already at the house, you know. In a sense, in that culture, you know, she's kind of damaged goods at this point. And so he's saying, hey, how much do you want for the girl? Just name your price. He really wants her. This is disgusting. It's like, you know, a used car, and say, hey, you know what? My son really wants this car. What's it going to take for me to take it home? And the sons are not going to have any of this. Verse 13. "But the sons of Jacob answered Shechem and Hamor his father, and they spoke deceitfully, because he had defiled Dinah their sister. And they said to them, 'We cannot do this thing to give our sister to one who is uncircumcised, for that would be a reproach to us. But on this condition we will consent to you. If you will become as we are, if every male of you is circumcised, then we will give our daughters to you, and we will take your daughters to us, and we will dwell with you, and we will become one people. But if you will not heed us and be circumcised, then we will take our daughter and be gone.'" So the sons of Jacob are pretty quick on their feet. They come up with this scheme that will enable them to exact revenge for the shameful treatment of Dinah. Now, so this is basically what they're proposing. Hey, only if all you males get circumcised, and then we'll intermarry with your people, and hey, it's okay then, because it's just this is kind of the caveat we have to have. But sadly, the sons of Jacob are of such a poor character that they're willing to take what was given to them as a sacred symbol and instead use it for a sinful purpose. Now, the sons of Jacob knew full well that they were not going to intermarry with the people of Shechem. This is just a ruse. They had another plan in mind. Verse 18, "And their words pleased Hamor and Shechem, Hamor's son. And so the young man did not delay to do the thing, because he delighted in Jacob's daughter." Okay, so Shechem is the first one up. He's willing to be circumcised because he really wanted Dinah as his wife. And at first glance, you might say, wow, that's quite a commitment. But I would argue that this is not all that surprising. In human history, we've seen that men will do a great deal to get the woman that they desire. So I believe that he's according to the flesh. He's like, okay, if this is the hoop that I have to get through so I can keep this woman, then that's what I'm willing to do. Then we read in verse 19, something that seems a little out of place. It says, he was more honorable than all the household of his father. I think that this is a poor translation because nothing that we've seen so far shows us that he is honorable. The ESV translates it this way. Now he was the most honored of all his father's house. Okay, so what's being presented here is that once Shechem goes ahead and does this, because the other guys like look up to Shechem, they say, okay, we'll do it too. So Shechem was not an honorable guy as such, but he was the most honored in Hamor's household. He was a guy that other people in the city looked up to. And we know from human history that you don't have to be a good guy to be respected by others. Look at the heroes of our culture. The heroes of our culture are by and large scummy people, ungodly people, people who have made it to where they are by stepping on others, by beating up others, by criticizing others, by living ungodly lifestyles. And so Shechem was a guy who was honored but was not honorable. Verse 20. And Hamor and Shechem, his son, came to the gate of their city and spoke with the men of their city, saying, these men are at peace with us. Therefore, let them dwell in the land and trade in it. For indeed, the land is large enough for them. Let us take their daughters to us as wives, and let us give them our daughters. Only on this condition will the men consent to dwell with us, to be one people. If every male among us is circumcised as they are circumcised, will not their livestock, their property, and every animal of theirs be ours? Only let us consent to them, and they will dwell with us. So we have the duplicity on the one side, the falsehood of the sons of Jacob who say, hey, just do this thing and it'll all be good. And they're lying about that. But we have this double duplicity. We have the duplicity on Hamor and Shechem's side who say, hey, let's just jump through this hoop because at the end of the day, we're going to get all this stuff. We're going to intermarry and we will take over and everything that is Jacob's will become ours. So we see the duplicity of Hamor here. The whole deal wasn't just about Dinah. She was a convenient inroad into getting all of Jacob's possessions. They didn't just want the girl. They wanted everything that Jacob owned. Verse 24, and all who went out of the gate of his city heeded Hamor and Shechem, his son. Every male was circumcised. All who went out of the gate of the city. So the greed of Hamor and the greed of the rest of the men of the city led them to be circumcised. Verse 25, and now it came to pass on the third day when they were in pain, that the two sons of Jacob, Simeon and Levi, Dinah's brothers. Okay. And before we get to the rest of this verse, please note here in verse 25 that Simeon and Levi were full brothers of Dinah. And they're going to do something about what's taken place. And they were children of Leah. Seems horrible to say, but it makes you wonder if Jacob would have done more, if he would have been more concerned about Dinah if she were Rachel's daughter and not Leah's daughter. Now, continuing on in verse 25, we read, now it came to pass on the third day, when they were in pain, that two of the sons of Jacob, Simeon and Levi, Dinah's brothers, each took his sword and came boldly upon the city and killed all the males. And they killed Hamor and Shechem, his son, with the edge of the sword, and took Dinah from Shechem's house and went out. So what we have here is this destruction, this slaughter, this murder, this ungodly overreaction to the crime of one man. You see, if Simeon and Levi had truly been interested in justice, they would have demanded that Shechem be punished and said, you better give us our sister back and you better do something to that boy or there's going to be trouble. But they didn't do that. They deceitfully waited till these guys could not fight back and they killed all the males of the city. That should not have happened. Verse 27, the sons of Jacob came upon the slain and plundered the city because their sister had been defiled. They took their sheep, their oxen, and their donkeys, and what was in the city and what was in the field, and all their wealth, all their little ones and their wives they took captive, and they plundered even all that was in the houses. Once all the males were killed, then the unnamed sons of Jacob joined in the looting of the city. We don't know exactly which of these sons it were, what they did. I would assume Joseph was not involved, as we see from his character. But these other sons do this thing. They participate in this looting of the city, this mob mentality. And it's a terrible thing. It's a tragic thing. But you know, one of the things about this section of Scripture, though, it reminds you that the Scriptures are telling you the truth. You know, the fact that it would show the hero, these people who become the 12 tribes of the nation of Israel, that it shows their wickedness. It shows the wrong they've done. It just speaks of truth. The Bible is recording things as they actually happen, not some sanitized fake version of events. It's telling the truth. These were fallen people. Verse 30, then Jacob said to Simeon and Levi, you have troubled me by making me obnoxious among the inhabitants of the land, among the Canaanites and the Perizzites. And since I am few in number, they will gather themselves together against me and kill me. I shall be destroyed, my household and I. Once again, Jacob is only concerned with his own safety and not with the great wrong that had been done. D.G. Barnhouse says, Jacob, you brought that trouble on yourself. You passed your own deceitful nature into your boys. You set them a constant example of guile. They heard you lie to Esau and Peniel and start northwest after he went southwest. They saw your interest in the fat pastures when you pitched your tent in Shechem. You said nothing when Dinah was violated. Talk to God about your own sin before talking to these boys about theirs. Ouch. In verse 31, but they said, should he treat our sister like a harlot? Now, this was no excuse for the bloodshed brought about by Simeon and Levi, but it was enough to shut Jacob up. Because Jacob had done nothing after the rape of Dinah, and because of his inaction, he was in no place to rebuke Simeon and Levi. This is a sad state of affairs, and it's a bad place to stop. But we'll have to stop here. And as we close, I want to simply ask, you know, does your character matter to you? Does your character matter to you? You know, are you seeking, as the Lord God, as God the Father, seeks to conform your character to the character of Christ, are you cooperating in that work? Is that something that's important to you? Because for every believer, it should be. And not only just in some kind of a metaphysical sense, or just, I want to do this because I want to be the best person possible, but to realize that the work that God has for us to do in this world, it's an outflow of our character. As God conforms our character more and more to the image of Christ, the more and more He can use us. And the more and more we're going to be a blessing to others. But if we refuse to cooperate in that, if we refuse to have our character conform to the image of Christ, if we kind of just lean into our own sinful tendencies, then we're going to see a bunch of messes come up in our lives because character matters.